When you wonder, you're learning. Mr. Rogers' Enduring Lessons for Raising Creative, Curious, Caring Kids by Greg Bear and Ryan Rydzowski, forward by Joanne Rogers. Chapter 3, It All Works Out If You Talk and You Listen. Communication. I have some pictures to show you, says our man in the sweater. It's a beautiful day in Studio A, and Mr. Rogers holds up an album. This is the way my dad and mother looked when I was a little boy. The camera moves in for a close-up. There's Fred's father, Jim Rogers, looking dapper in a three-piece pinstripe. There's Nancy McFeely, Fred's doting mother, and Latrobe's beloved do-gooder. Fred in his father's fine hair and his mother's warm smile. He beams at their memory. Very special people, he muses. It's pure, unadulterated Rogers, a shot of 100-proof wholesomeness you won't find anywhere else. What could be more decent, more moral, more pleasant than America's neighbor fondly recalling his parents? There's a reverent pause. The camera pans over the photos, and then Rogers says it. Did you ever wish you could marry your mom or your dad? He gives us a moment to shift uncomfortably in our seats. Where exactly is this going? Just what does Mr. Wholesome think he's doing? When I was 4 or 5 years old, he said, I thought when I grew up that I would marry my mother. It's a hard left turn, one that crashes through the median and into oncoming traffic, but there's an earnestness to what Rogers says. His candor disarms the topic like it disarms everything else. The first day of school, the death of a goldfish, a divorce in the family. My mom was very helpful to me by when she told me, then, when I was very young like you. Somewhere offset, a piano plays, a host smiles his mother's smile, and then he leans in to tell us what she said. Deep listening and loving speech. It was just after 7 a.m. when Vav Terdendayan heard it, the steady, unmistakable thrum of a nearby helicopter. He went outside to look, but he couldn't pinpoint the source. The noise seemed to shift ever so slightly, always hovering just beyond his sight. As he set out from his apartment, hitting the streets in the sunny California morning, he decided to text his boss. This impromptu investigation, he figured, would probably make him late. Terdan did not stared at his phone as he walked. The roar of the rotors grew louder. Then all of a sudden, the helicopter's presence made total terrifying sense. It had been following an animal, specifically the 400-pound bear, just inches from Terdandandan's face. He had been too wrapped up in his text message to notice. Footage of Terdandandan spinning around and sprinting away went viral, joining the medley of warnings about the perils of distracted texting. Not that it had any effect. Years later, thousands of people annually still get hurt while walking and texting. We text while driving too, accounting for 1 out of every 4 car accidents. We text at the dinner table, in bed, in meetings, on dates. By the time you finish this page, some 16 million texts and emojis will have hurtled through the air. Meanwhile, when we're not texting, we're checking. On average, Americans look at their phones some 52 times a day. An average adult spends nearly 4 hours a day looking at a smartphone. Teenagers log more than 7. We simply can't help ourselves. Human beings are hardwired to communicate. It's fundamental to our survival and well-being. Our lives are shaped by it from beginning to end. We come out of the womb and we cry. We learn to point, listen, respond, and write. When we die, we utter our famous last words. Some companies have even developed software promising a social afterlife, posting tweets and Facebook posts from beyond a user's grave. Though nearly all living things communicate in one way or another, humans have taken it one step further. We've developed language. Without it, we'd have to literally reinvent the wheel, perhaps for the millionth time. Language lets us pass along knowledge built on old ideas and deepen our connections with other people. When we lose those connections, we suffer immensely. Think of the agitated toddler in time out, the heartbreaking broken lover in an empty house, the person in prison coming undone in solitary confinement. We need to communicate like we need water and air. All of this explains, to some degree, the attentional black holes that spring from our smartphones. Every notification, every text, every like on your latest post sends a shot of dopamine to the brain, the same feel-good chemical released during exercise and meals. The more shots we get, the more we want to get, and so our phones become the first thing we see in the morning and the last thing we see at night. They promise unlimited chances to communicate, something we're programmed to crave from birth. Unfortunately, smartphones aren't enough on their own. Despite the technology's ubiquity, nearly half of American adults say they're isolated from others. The average person hasn't made a new friend in 5 years. In Britain, most seniors say their primary companions are pets or televisions. And in Japan, one survey counted 500,000 young people who hadn't interacted with anyone for 6 months or more. This isn't just tragic, it's a real public health crisis. Loneliness has been linked to heart disease, strokes, and Alzheimer's. One study equated its health effects to a 15-cigarette-a-day smoking habit. A survey in Britain named loneliness the number one fear among young people today. More terrifying than cancer or homelessness. The so-called loneliness epidemic has gotten so bad that some countries' response seemed torn from dystopian novels. In 2018, Britain appointed the first Minister for Loneliness, a government employee tasked with addressing the sad reality of modern life. Something is broken. We're talking and texting, but not connecting. This isn't technology's fault, of course. Tech is only a tool. But with smartphone detox camps springing up around the world, it's fair to say that something needs to change. Our physical health, our mental well-being, the strength of our relationships and democracies may depend on it. Fortunately, a chorus of psychologists, learning scientists, and even Buddhist monks can point us towards something better. To lead a happy and successful life, argues one team of researchers, one must master the skills that support effective communication and the form of communicating they encounter most commonly. In other words, the better we communicate, the better off we'll be. Researchers have found clear links between communication skills and one's relationship quality, academic success, job performance, and income. In Silicon Valley, managers seeking employees who can communicate with each other and with customers have begun hiring English majors alongside engineers, prompting Forbes to call liberal arts degrees tech's hottest ticket. The implications is that people who hold such degrees bring proven communication skills to the table. But what are those skills? Communication is a big concept, one that encompasses reading, writing, speaking, and listening. Then there's everything nonverbal, our tones of voice, our eye rolls, our embraces. When we have something to say, we have to deploy the right tools to craft the right message using the right channel, all while those channels continue to multiply. A quick scan of our office alone reveals iPhones, PowerPoints, Post-its, emails, tweets, texts, Snapchats, and WhatsApps. In the face of so much complexity, perhaps it's best to start with something simple. In his 2013 book, The Art of Communicating, Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese poet, scholar, and monk, boils effective communication down to two basic elements: deep listening and loving speech. Deep listening and loving speech, he writes, are the best instruments I know for establishing and restoring communication with others and relieving suffering. Fortunately for us, no one listened more deeply or spoke more lovingly than Fred McFeely Rogers. Putting feelings first. There he is in his living room, still in that sweater, still discussing that same awkward topic. My mother told me that she was already married to my daddy, he said, and maybe someday I would find a wife of my own. Readers, if you were hoping for a one-off moment, an uncomfortable but fleeting aside, then we have bad news. Rogers even wrote a song about marrying his mom. A rather long song, he said, as the music begins to play. One day I said, I'm really going to marry my mom. I told my mom, I'm really going to marry you. She smiled, didn't laugh, said, I hope you will marry, maybe someone like me. But you see, she said, I'm already married. I'm married to your daddy. The first few lines of Going to Marry Mom look admittedly strange on paper. Of all things to sing about, why linger on a little misconception like this one? Why focus on something so mundane when the bigger problems of childhood loom so large? Imagine for a moment that you're Nancy McFeely. You're sitting in your parlor in Latrobe, maybe planning a fundraiser for a neighbor who's down on her luck, when your 4-year-old son bursts into the room and declares he wants to marry you. As an adult, you have a range of responses to choose from. You could, for example, set the facts straight and get back to what you were doing. Moms and kids don't marry one another, Freddie. Now, please, I'm very busy. You could deploy some light parental sarcasm. I don't think so, pal. Or deny his incorrect desire. You don't want to marry me, kiddo. You could also play along, perhaps giving a good-natured chuckle. Such innocence is, after all, undeniably cute. But now let's imagine you're Freddy. You've been in your room all day making up stories with your puppet friends. You just staged the make-believe wedding of James Michael Jones and Betty Okanak Templeton when all of a sudden it hits you. One day you're going to marry the person you love most in the world. Thrilled by this realization and proud that you deduced it yourself, you rush to the parlor to tell her. Songs like Going to Marry Mom remind us that to children, mundane moments aren't always so mundane. What might look to adults like a simple misunderstanding could, to a child, be an expression of love and the need to be loved. In that sense, Freddie's question carries unspeakable weight. Answered well, the moment can affirm the deepest human desire to feel oneself beloved and on the earth, as the writer Raymond Carver once put it. Answered not so well, the moment can be devastating. If the stakes here make you nervous, you're not alone. Everyday life is full of reminders that effective communication takes practice, skill, and lots of hard work, especially when it comes to kids. Conversing with children is a unique art with rules and meanings of its own, writes the late psychologist Haim Ganat in his best-selling classic, Between Parents and Child. According to Ganat, to speak well with children, it helps to learn a new kind of communication, one that helps us discipline without humiliating, criticize without demeaning, and praise without judging. It's here that experts from different fields, places, and eras converge, whether it's Haim Ganat of Israel, or Thich Nhat Hanh of Vietnam, or Margaret McFarland of Pittsburgh. Psychologists, Zen masters, and child development experts alike nearly all agree on a similar point, that effective communication, above all else, acknowledges and respects children's feelings. We don't necessarily have to agree with those feelings, but we should refrain from ridiculing or condemning them, even when we feel they're unjustified. Which brings us back to the Rogers family living room, where 4-year-old Freddie had just told his mother he wants to marry her. Of the countless ways she could have responded, we know, thanks to the song he sang some 50 years later, that Nancy McFeely not only acknowledged her son's need to be loved, but also managed to teach him what marriage means without mocking him or making him feel like a fool. In fact, a few lines show how deftly she handled the whole situation. She smiled, didn't laugh, said, I hope you will marry, maybe someone like me. And as you grow more and more like your daddy, you'll find a lady like me. And she'll love you as I love your daddy, and she will marry you, and I hope you will have little children, and they will be like you. Because mothers and dads have special love for children, especially children like you. It all works out if you talk and you listen, because someone cares about you. Yes, someone cares about you. Roger repeats certain lines again and again, as if speaking directly to the adults in the room. Communication with children, he reminds us, doesn't come easily. It's a learning process, one to which Rogers committed himself with monk-like dedication. We'll get into that later on, but for now, a brief example to show how meticulous our man in the sweater could be. Hedda Sherapan remembers a taping in which a neighborhood cast member told Henrietta Pussycat not to cry. The make-believe scenes were tightly scripted, but now and then spontaneous things happened in the conversation between puppets and people, she says. When Henrietta started to cry, the actress said caringly, "Oh, Henrietta, don't cry." Fred stopped the taping, came out from behind the set, and said, "When we say, don't cry, we're really saying, I have trouble handling that. I wonder if you can find another way to help Henrietta." And she did. The actress just comforted her. In the neighborhood, all feelings were valid. Every emotion was worthy of expression. Anything that's human is mentionable, and anything that is mentionable can be more manageable, Rogers once said. When we can talk about our feelings, they become less overwhelming, less upsetting, and less scary. The people we trust with that important talk can help us know that we are not alone. Listening is where love begins. Sometimes when the weights we carry grow heavy, what we need more than anything is someone who's willing to listen. Sometimes it's an old friend. Sometimes it's a spouse, a parent, or a neighbor. Sometimes it's a professional. There's a reason Americans spend tens of billions of dollars a year on mental health treatment, including counseling. It feels good to talk, even when our listeners can't solve our problem or take away our pain. Often we simply need to be heard. At times of strong emotions, writes Gannat, there is nothing as comforting and helpful as a person who listens and understands. What is true for adults is also true for children. Rogers understood this on a level that captivated his audience, both on screen and off. His friends and staff remember him as an extraordinary listener, someone more interested in hearing their stories than he was in telling his own. Journalists, of course, found this tendency maddening. His office at WQED was more living room than workspace, recalls one former colleague. Rogers refused a desk, considering it too much of a barrier between his visitors and himself. Instead, he'd sit on a couch or a reclining chair and listen. It was the same story when he encountered his viewers out in the real world. Bill Eisler recalls rushing through the Boston airport with Rogers when a parent stopped them to introduce her three-year-old. The little boy came over and gave Fred an ice cube, and Fred bent down with the ice cube in his hand and just talked to the child until the ice cube melted. When he talked to children, he was always down on one knee. He always got down to eye level. He knew how important that was, no matter what was happening around him. That always blew me away. Despite his medium's limitation, Rogers put listening front and center in the neighborhood. When he asked his viewers a question, "What do you think about when you look at this African violet?" he left space for their answers. He would ask a question and leave time for children to develop a response, says Sherapan. Part of allowing children to be curious is giving them silence, trust, and space, letting them know that it's okay to still be thinking about something and to not have an answer right away. Although Rogers couldn't hear his viewers' response in real time, he managed to listen another way, through the mail. The Fred Rogers archive in Latrobe's houses some 30 years worth of notes from kids and adults alike, many of whom simply wanted to thank him for his steady presence in their lives. The mail was so important to him, that was his feedback, says Sherapan. The first thing he did every day when he came into the office was look at the mail that was waiting for him. When you're taping in a television studio, you are talking to a camera and have no idea how people are reacting. That's why he's so appreciated that people took the time to write. He also felt that each letter deserved a meaningful response, a signal that someone was listening. "More and more," he wrote, "I've come to understand that listening is one of the most important things we can do for one another." Whether the other be an adult or a child, our engagement in listening to who that person is can often be our greatest gift. Whether that person is speaking or playing or dancing, building or singing or painting, if we care, we can listen. This is what Thich Nhat Hanh means by deep listening, the patient act of ensuring that someone feels acknowledged, valued, and heard. Deep listening can take lots of forms, but in every case, it's rooted in compassion rather than criticism. When we listen to someone with the intention of helping that person suffer less, this is deep listening. Nhat Hanh wrote, when we listen with compassion, we don't get caught up in judgment. A judgment may form, but we don't hold on to it. This means listening to children uncritically, at least at first. For parents, it's sometimes a tall order. We're criticizing, lecturing, advice-dispensing creatures. It's in our DNA. Though we don't always differentiate between children's feelings and children's behavior, it's possible, even necessary, to empathize with the former before reacting to the latter. Like everyone else, children withholding their feelings when they fear they'll be shamed, punished, or worse for expressing them. Being supportive often means waiting and listening and more waiting until you're better able to understand the drama that a certain child is living through at the moment, says Rogers. Sometimes that may actually be keeping him or her from learning well. Imagine, for example, that your fourth grade daughter comes home from school in tears. She slams her bag on the table, sending a glass of water shattering across the floor. Before you can speak, she screams, "Miss Applebaum yelled at me today." Or make believe this, it's the day of a big wedding and Daniel Striped Tiger is refusing to get dressed. He's decided after several practice attempts that he can't carry the ring down the aisle without it slipping off the pillow. "I can't be a ring bearer," he cries to the adults around him. "I just can't be. The more I think about it, the worse it seems to me." In situations like these, our instincts is often to act and to ask our shaken daughter what she did to deserve her teacher's scolding, or to teach Daniel Tiger how to hold the ring so that he can get dressed and get on with it. As parents, teaching and fixing are major parts of the job description. We jump in with our hard-won wisdom, correcting and protecting, building up and dressing down. The internet is full of horror stories about parents who take this too far, assaulting youth sports referees or accompanying their grown children to job interviews. But in our rush to fix children's problems, we sometimes skip a crucial step, taking time to just listen, even when we don't like what we hear. What if, instead of reacting, we resolve to simply receive for a while? What if, like Rogers, we committed to listening more deeply, even when there's a glass on the floor, or we're going to be late for a wedding? We might be surprised what we learn. Consider our daughter in distress. If we begin by accusing her of deserving Miss Applebaum's wrath, we're not going to get very far, even though we suspect she's in the wrong. Feelings are stronger than logic, and they have to be dealt with first. That is, they have to be heard by someone who will listen without critiquing. If we try to interrupt or correct the other person, he will transform the session into a debate and it will ruin everything, writes Nhat Hanh. After all, we have deeply listened and allowed the other person to express everything in his heart. We'll have a chance later to give him a little of that information he needs to correct his perception, but not now. Now we just listen, even if the person says things that are wrong. This is easier said than done, especially mid-meltdown. But we can take a moment to acknowledge our daughter's feelings, perhaps by saying, "You sound very upset. You must have had a really difficult day." This tells her we're listening and that it's safe to say more. Maybe she did deserve her teacher's wrath, but perhaps she acted out because she's being bullied, or because she's struggling with math, or because she can't see the blackboard from her seat. The bottom line is that we can deal with misbehaviors later. Right now, it is more important to hear what our daughter is telling us. When I'm upset or hurting, the last thing I want to hear is advice, philosophy, psychology, or other fellows' points of view, explained Adele Faber and Ellen Mashlish, authors of How to Talk So Kids Will Listen and Listen So Kids Will Talk. Unlike your present co-authors, Faber and Mashlish use the singular I. But let someone really listen. Let someone acknowledge my inner pain and give me a chance to talk more about what's troubling me. And I begin to feel less upset, less confused, more able to cope with my feelings and my problem. And what of Daniel Tiger? In this particular episode, another puppet, Betty Okecon Templeton, jumps in to fix his ring problem using a little scotch tape to keep it on the pillow. And yet Daniel still won't get dressed. It's the kind of scenario that vexes parents everywhere. The issue gets resolved, but the reaction doesn't change. Daniel's still terrified, and now everyone's going to be late. Frustration builds and builds. Perhaps by jumping in too quickly with the scotch tape solution, the adults around Daniel miss the underlying concern. Kids, after all, tend to speak in code. Sometimes their fears take a bit of deciphering. Roberta Schomburg of the Fred Rogers Center recalls when her young daughter had a difficult time accepting a baby brother. She painted a picture of the baby at school, and I told her it was beautiful, she says, laughing. Then her teacher showed me the caption on the painting. She had named it the Hand of the Monster and painted a blue blob hanging over the baby's head. I thought, oh dear. Sometimes, in other words, it's not really about carrying the wedding ring. And in fact, when Betty Okecon Templeton approaches Daniel a second time, giving him space to speak, she eventually learns that he's misheard ring bearer as ring bear. I'm a tiger, he cries, and I don't want to be a bear. No wonder Daniel won't get dressed. The task had threatened his entire identity. It's only when an adult was willing to listen and take his real concerns could be discovered, discussed, and resolved. Fred recognized that children have underlying motivations for the things they say and do, motivations that they probably aren't even aware of themselves, says Schomburg. And those motivations can come out in odd ways, like in the titles of children's paintings. And so we have to listen for that. Indeed, when we make a point of listening more than we talk, we'll sometimes find that listening is enough on its own. We don't always have to act or give advice or have something meaningful to say. When your daughter's upset or Daniel Tiger won't get dressed, they're not necessarily seeking solutions. Sometimes they just want someone to hear them. When your loved one is suffering, writes Nahan, your impulse may be to want to do something to fix it, but you don't need to do much. You just need to be there for him or her. That is true love. Simple interactions. In the early 1980s, Rogers released a series called Mr. Rogers Talks with Parents. Though largely forgotten, these programs did for adults what the neighborhood did for kids. They provided a framework for talking through difficult topics like daycare, divorce, and school. Though Rogers largely avoided prescriptive advice, the major messages to parents stayed constant, writes author Ellen Galinsky. Take the time to listen and to understand your children and yourself, and the appropriate solutions to problems will become evident. You are the expert, so have confidence in yourself. It's easy to forget among parenting's complexities and frustrations, but each of us is like Roger's mother, an expert. We're all capable of a well-timed embrace, a supportive smile, or something else that makes children feel valued. We might not know it or think about it or even be able to name it, but when it comes to communicating with kids, we all have strengths that ought to be recognized. It's something that Dana Winters knows better than anyone. A professor of child and family studies at the Fred Rogers Center, a large part of Winter's career has involved filming children's helpers, educators, caregivers, parents, and anyone else who works with kids. I spent 6 months filming the crossing guards of Pittsburgh, she says, laughing. You'd be surprised what crossing guards can do for children in very small moments. It's just amazing. Winter's direct, simple interactions, a strength-based approach to noticing and affirming exactly the sort of moments that Rogers described in Going to Marry Mom. The tender moments of closeness that form the building blocks of a loving relationship. They happen every hour of every day among every kind of person, says Winters, and by learning to notice them, we can learn to make more of them. It works like this. Winters and her team filmed unscripted, almost random interactions among children and helpers. It doesn't necessarily matter what gets filmed. I could show up and film for 2 hours on any given Tuesday and have enough material to do this for years, she says. Though they tend to gravitate towards routines. Small, seemingly unimportant moments like feeding or changing a diaper happen all the time, says Winters. So what might we do in those moments to elevate the interaction? Afterwards, Winters and her team play the videos back for the helpers using the simple interactions tool to describe specific moments. In each interaction, how did the helper forge connections with children? How were they present in the way they communicated, in the ways they received and responded to the kids in their care? Did they make children feel included, valued, loved? Overwhelmingly, says Winters, we hear two things when we play back the video. The first is, I don't remember that moment, which shows just how ordinary these moments really are. The second is, I don't even know what I was doing, which I think speaks to helpers having a lack of confidence in their practice and a lack of awareness of how much good they're really doing. The simple interactions approach helps create that awareness. As a group, the helpers identify moments of connection and reciprocity, as well as opportunities for kids to belong and grow. And because the point of the program is to help adults learn from what they've already been doing, the helpers focus on each other's strengths. It's a deeply reflective process, Winters explains. It's not evaluative, it's not scored. It simply helps us describe these moments so that we can be more intentional about how and when they happen. Perhaps Nancy McFeely scooping up Freddie in her parlor, explaining that moms and dads have a special love for the kids. How could we describe that moment using the simple interactions tool? Certainly, it's one of connection, of mutual presence, of being in tune with Freddie's emotions. And it's certainly a two-way serve and return conversation. With Freddie proposing marriage and his mother responding and expounding in a loving way. There's evidence that engaging in back and forth conversations like these can boost children's language skills. And it's unquestionably a moment of growth. Of course, Freddie's mother wasn't thinking about any of this when he burst into the room. More likely, she was simply reacting, the same thing most of us do when caring for kids. But when we have the language, tools, and space to think about interactions like this one, we can become more intentional about the ways we approach them. The next time Nancy McFeely hears a surprising question from Freddie, she'll likely remember the comfort she brought him when she smiled but didn't laugh, and she'll know how to react accordingly. First developed by Winter's colleague, Harvard University lecturer, and former co-director of the family of the Fred Rogers Center, Junli Li, Simple Interactions has reached more than 25,000 helpers in classrooms, orphanages, libraries, and museums around the world. And because it's freely available online, it's increasingly used by parents and families working to understand their own interactions with children. I've had parents come to me and say, I'm making a decision for my child right now and something doesn't feel right, says Winters. And then they go to the tool and say, oh, what I'm doing actually doesn't encourage, enrich, and empower human relationships. That's why it doesn't feel good. Winters pauses, then laughs. I even had a woman tell me that she uses the tool to understand her relationship with her mother-in-law. That's when I know it can really work for anyone. In classrooms, simple interactions has been shown to reduce teacher depression and increase psychological safety. That is, teachers' willingness to experiment and try new things, despite the risk of failure. It's also been shown to improve relationships and communication among adults and kids, and Winters thinks she knows why. We push back against the idea that either you can interact with people or you can't, she says. The best communicators and best interactors got that way by working at it and developing their craft. Fred Rogers used to say that there are no shortcuts to developing a relationship. And we don't take shortcuts. Every day we're focused on those basic building blocks. Many ways to say, I love you. If simple interactions are the building blocks of human relationships, then deep listening and loving speech are the double helix that holds them together. It's by listening deeply that we help alleviate other people's suffering. And it's by speaking lovingly that we express ourselves, whether we're communicating affection, anger, or anything else in between. Loving speech comes in countless forms and convey almost anything. Thich Nhat Hanh writes that speech is loving when it communicates our presence to others and lets others know that their presence matters to us. It doesn't always mean saying, I love you, though that's certainly part of it. An arm around the shoulder can be loving speech. So can a protest. So can a phone call or a text message or a business presentation. When babies cry, our blood pressure spikes and our heart rate rises, prompting a response. That's loving speech too. Rogers himself wrote an ode to this. Here's a snippet of many ways to say, I love you. Cleaning up a room can say, I love you. Hanging up a coat before you're asked to. Drawing special pictures for the holidays and making plays. You'll find many ways to say, I love you. You'll find many ways to understand what love is. Many ways, ways, many ways, many ways to say, I love you. The Neighborhood was, in a sense, a 30-year sermon on loving speech's value, on its importance in a world where reserves of it seem to be dwindling, and where speech that demeans and humiliates has become the new normal. It might seem quaint in a time when the meanest tweets get the most attention, but for all the acrimony that's crept into our discourse, loving speech remains the most powerful communication tool we have. It's one that works in every setting, from the classroom to the boardroom. All of us long to hear that we are accepted as we are, says Rogers. That kind of message can draw the world together. It's this longing that turned Rogers' chance encounter with a television into a sort of conversion experience. In 1951, during his final year as an undergraduate at Rollins College in Florida, Rogers returned to La Trobe for a short break. His parents, he discovered, had recently bought a strange glowing box, an invention that was still relatively rare at the time, but which would soon transform American life like little else had before it. Throughout most of the 1940s, just a few thousand households owned televisions. By the time Rogers first saw one, the number had soared to about 3.8 million, a figure that would multiply 12-fold within a decade. In a striking example of the new technology's influence, officials in Toledo, Ohio, announced in 1954 that they discovered a strange phenomenon. The city's water use was surging at regular intervals each night, as if everyone in town was running their faucets at once. An investigation eventually revealed that television had synchronized Toledo's residents. Families all over town were flushing their toilets during the same commercial breaks. It was in that enchanting machine that Rogers glimpsed his future for the first time. He didn't like what he saw. I saw people throwing pies at each other's faces, he told a reporter a half century later. And that, to me, was such demeaning behavior. And if there's anything that bothers me, it's one person demeaning another. Rogers knew at once what he had to do. He postponed his plans to enter the seminary and went instead to New York City, where he learned the nuts and bolts of television production. Upon returning to Pittsburgh in 1953, he worked for WQED, the country's first community-sponsored television station. During his lunch hours, he worked towards his Master of Divinity degree at what is today the Pittsburgh Theological Seminary, which connected him to McFarlane and his studies in child development. After a brief detour to Canada, he eventually returned to Pittsburgh and began creating The Neighborhood, a beacon of loving speech that would, as Rogers once put it, broadcast grace through the land. As a communicator and television host, Rogers held his responsibility sacred. The space between the television screen and whoever happens to be receiving it, I considered that very holy ground, he told an interviewer. A lot happens there. That's why he went to such extraordinary lengths to ensure that the neighborhood spoke lovingly to viewers, that it affirmed their dignity and humanity and self-worth. A typical script-writing session required hours of consultation with McFarland. Then came several rounds of revision as Rogers made change after exacting change. Even after all of that, Rogers would sometimes stop a shoot, a cardinal sin in the highly expensive world of television production, notes Maxwell King, and go back to McFarland for advice. To outside observers, and sometimes to Rogers' own staff, this all seemed a little extreme, especially for a program that spent half its time in a make-believe puppet world. But Rogers had good reason to take such care. He knew how thoroughly children absorb the speech they hear, regardless of whether that speech is loving. And he knew that to counter the tsunami of advertising and negativity and dehumanization that threatened to drown out everything else, he'd have to speak relentlessly, unfailingly lovingly, no matter how many times it meant trudging the half mile between his studio and McFarland's office. Of course, most of us can't spend hours crafting our lives in 28-minute segments. Things go wrong, a parent gets sick, a creditor calls, a car breaks down. The pressures and heartaches of everyday life can shake even the strongest commitment to loving speech. So where does that leave us? The first thing we can do is cut ourselves some slack. Learning to speak lovingly is a lifelong process, one that even Rogers had to work at. He consulted with McFarlane until her death in 1988 and relied on a team of child development experts until the very end of his career, a team that continues his work today at Fred Rogers Productions. The difference between Rogers and everyone else wasn't that he'd been gifted with some special saintly capacity for loving speech. It was that he committed himself to speaking more lovingly every day of his life, even when doing so seemed futile. And it seemed futile more often than we'd like to admit. Consider all the times you've heard someone demean or hurt another person. The spouse who takes shot at each other over dinner. The strangers who berates a bus driver. The boss who rules by insults and threats. It's easy to think that we ourselves would never do such things, but the truth is that all of us speak less lovingly at times, especially when dealing with kids. We would like to believe that only a disturbed parent responds in a way that is damaging to a child, writes Haim Gnat. Unfortunately, even parents who are loving and well-meaning also blame, shame, accuse, ridicule, threaten, bribe, label, punish, preach, and moralize. He gives a startling but relatable example. What do we say to a guest who forgets her umbrella? Do we run after her and say, "What is the matter with you? Every time you come to visit, you forget something." If it's not one thing, it's another. Why can't you be like your younger sister? When she comes to visit, she always knows how to behave. You're 44 years old. Will you never learn? I'm not a slave to pick up after you. I bet you'd forget your head if it weren't attached to your shoulders. We do this in subtler forms, too. Imagine a colleague complains that your office is too warm and starts to take off his sweater. You wouldn't respond by saying, "No, it's not too warm. Put that sweater back on, mister." Or imagine you're at the movies and your date, clearly moved, quietly starts to sob. You wouldn't look over and say, "I'll give you something to cry about." But with children, we're sometimes more than willing to deny their emotions and tell them that their inner selves can't be trusted. These habits are passed down from our parents and teachers and from their parents and teachers and so on. Among adults, most common refrains would be, "Willing to bet, I sound just like my mother," ranks somewhere near the top. And while there are certainly some advantages to this, at some point, for example, we all need to hear that money doesn't grow on trees, these patterns can lead us to speak to children in ways we wouldn't dream of speaking to anyone else. Especially, it must be said, when we're angry. It's a cruel irony that loving speech seems most difficult when it's also most needed. That is, when emotions are already running hot. But anger and loving speech aren't mutually exclusive. Anger can and should be expressed in healthy ways. Ways that don't hurt yourself or anybody else. As Rogers often put it, parents can do this by following a simple rule. Except for one safeguard, we are entitled to express what we feel, writes Gannat. We can express our angry feelings, provided we do not attack the child's personality or character. Again, the simple interactions tool can be helpful. Consider your interactions on any given day and describe where they fall on the spectrum. That moment, we sat down with our upset daughter, empathized with her frustration, and lovingly asked her about what was going on at school. That was squarely in the Z zone, a moment of mutual presence and conversation and growth. That moment we berated her for forgetting her umbrella, that was more along the lines of X or Y. It was hostile and one-sided, and it attacked her character instead of offering support. Most of the time, our interactions will span the tool spectrum, and that's okay. Moments in Z aren't always better than moments in Y. There are times when X or Y moments are appropriate and necessary. Winters gives the examples of a shop class where kids can get hurt if they're not listening and complying. The point is that by describing and becoming more conscious of the ways we speak to children, we can be more deliberate about speaking to them lovingly, regardless of the patterns we've absorbed over time. And when we do that, we start to forge new patterns, patterns we invariably pass on to others. The legends of Kung Fu Joe. If every town has its character, Pittsburgh has an ensemble cast. There's Bergman, the amateur superhero who wanders the city donning a mask and cape, his superpowers battling bullies, pollution, and negativity. There's Rachel Ann Bovier, Pittsburgh's self-proclaimed premier poetess, whose motivational verse graces our billboards and classifieds. And then there's Andrew Anthony, better known to Pittsburgh as Kung Fu Joe. A second-degree black belt in Shaolin Kung Fu, Kung Fu Joe kicks and chops have made him a minor local celebrity. Passerbyers give high fives, toss coins in his tip jar, and generally wish him well. He's the friendly neighborhood mainstay whom people like but don't deeply know. The kind of guy whose backstory gets written by everyone else. The kind of guy who has happened in 2016, sometimes gets stabbed in the middle of the night, sparking rumors and hearsay and speculation that's taken as fact. Or at least he was, until he shared his story with a teenage TV crew called The Real Teens. The kids had the idea, said Wendy Bertner, sitting in her Southside office. They said, we want to go find Kung Fu Joe and figure out who he really is. So we talked about what their storyline might look like and how they might approach him and what kind of messages they might want to send. The documentary they made has, at this point, been in three or four different film festivals now. Bertner is president and CEO of Steeltown, a nonprofit that trains teenagers in film and digital media arts. Basically, she says, we take kids with a passion for digital media and help them follow that to what we hope is a profession. If they want to go work on big Hollywood movies, we'll help them figure out how to do that. If they want to do their own documentaries or get work at WQED, we'll help them do that too. Founded in 2003 by Maxine Lipidus, Ellen Wise Kander, and Carl Kurlander, kids in Steeltown's Film Academy develop their skills by taking on real-world work by paying clients. They also write, shoot, edit, and host The Real Teens, a documentary TV series that airs on local stations and YouTube. Every year, the nonprofit's teaching artists lead 30 to 40 teens through more than 100 hours of technical training, teaching them the basics of storytelling, camera work, audio recordings, and lighting. Kids learn what a close-up is and how a boom mic works. They learn to write for a wide audience, and because film captures things that they might not otherwise think about, such as body language and tone of voice, Steeltown students become better communicators in every sense of the word. These skills are relatively straightforward and can be taught by almost any competent filmmaker, says Bertner. The trickier part is helping kids bridge that holy ground between viewers and a screen, helping them captivate an audience and prompt a response like Rogers did. You have to teach kids to think about how they're going to make people feel, she says, and that's a whole lot more difficult than teaching them to hold a camera. Filmmakers Ian Attenbaud agreed. A teaching artist at Steeltown since 2016, Altenbaugh gives to students two rules, whether they're crafting something for a client or producing Real Teens episodes. The first has to do with intention. Kids communicate well when they know what they're trying to say and what they're trying and why they're trying to say it. They don't have to have a profound reason for it. If their purpose is just to make some people laugh, then that's awesome. They're bringing joy to people's lives, but they have to be able to articulate that. The second rule springs from loving speech. It's okay to tell stories about something that's weird or goofy or silly, but you have to do so with respect, she says, he says. There's no punching down. Your subject is a human being, so let's celebrate what makes them unique or different, not isolate them or turn them into an other. The result in programming, like the Kung Fu Joe documentary, television that humanizes and uplifts rather than ridicules and demeans, programming that, as Rogers might say, broadcasts grace throughout the land. Over the course of just 6.5 minutes, the Real Teens showed how a childhood marred by bullies and poverty led King Fu Joe to the martial arts. We glimpse his prior life as a bodybuilder, then as a panhandler, and then, as he puts it, a legend. We see the stab wound on his face and neck, and we learn for the first time what happened that night in 2016. Kung Fu Joe, it turns out, had intervened to stop an attempted rape. He nearly died in the struggle, but the victim made it to safety, a fact Joe credits to God and the martial arts. Now he sees himself as a South Side's protector. A lot of people depend on me, he tells the teens. I can't let them down. The program ends with Kung Fu Joe on the street telling his neighbors he loves them. It feels, in many ways, like the neighborhood spiritual sequel, a portrait of fearless authenticity produced by people determined to speak lovingly through a screen. Perhaps it's no wonder that Steeltown shares a building with Fred Rogers Productions. Teenagers could have made a different movie about someone like Kung Fu Joe, says Altenboro. Instead, they made a film that shows the world that he really wonderful person who cares about his neighbors and their well-being. And in turn, I think that film shows the world that it ought to care about him. Back in Studio A, Mr. Rogers stands at his fish tank. It's the same fish tank he stood at 100 times before, the place where he talks and listens one last time before he leaves. We've learned a lot about love today, he tells us. We've learned a lot about marriage and ring bearers and the special kind of love that moms and dads have for their kids. And we've learned that no matter what we feel inside, whether we're sad or we're scared or we want to marry our moms, it all works out if we talk lovingly and listen deeply. And even if the questions and feelings remain, that's okay. Questions and feelings are how we know we're growing. Do you sometimes wish that you could be the bride or the groom in a wedding? Rogers asks. It seems like a long time to wait until you're grown up enough to be a real bride or groom. Mr. Rogers waits for our answers in silence. Though he can't hear us, he listens. He wants us to know that whatever we say and whoever we are, there's someone out there who wants to know how we feel. There's someone out there who knows how deeply we want to be heard. What might you do? Talk to your kids about the mad that they feel, as Rogers puts it, or about their disappointments. Ask lots of open-ended questions when something's not going right or not going well. Sometimes the best thing to say is, "Can you tell me about it?" says Haydah Sharapan. We adults want to solve problems and avoid tears, but we might not know whether we're solving the right problems. Who would have guessed that Daniel Tiger was frightened about being something other than himself? How many times have you later learned that your child refused something like being a ring bearer with being a ring bear? Listening is sometimes enough. Tell your child ways that you express your anger or disappointment, ways that don't hurt yourself or anyone else. Let them know that sadness isn't forever. Even though we feel overwhelmed and frightened by our negative feelings, those feelings will always change with time. Almost everybody gets angry once in a while, and certainly I do, Rogers once explained. But do you know what I do when I'm angry? I like to swim, and so I swim extra hard when I'm angry. Experiment with simple interactions and practice using the tools. Maybe even pull out your smartphone and ask someone to record 10 minutes of your morning routine or your afternoon playtime. Then watch yourself and notice which moments are special or instructive or give you pause. Ask yourself what you might practice, the simple interactions that will help you be more deliberate and conscious of contributing to loving moments.